This is a continuation of Fort Reno, where I stopped in the middle of answering E of the last section. I was describing some affairs with Army wives at Reno, and I think I was on the question of the period that I was left alone there in command while the troops went on to Fort Riley. Anyway, all the women would waylay me as I went to the office to do this and that for them. I had very little I could do either this or that with, but I had found in one of the storage stables a lot of white lead. And my favorite reply was, I can't do that for you, but I will paint your bathroom white. However, I think at the time I stopped the other day, I was in the business of telling something about Soapsuds Row, where these soldiers' wives lived, or soldiers' widows. And the houses were very poorly constructed and in perfectly miserable, outrageous repair. Apparently nothing was ever done for them. I doubt if the house itself was on the records of the post. Anyway, I came along one day, walking down Soapsuds Row in a routine inspection of the post, and this wife waylaid me and asked me if I couldn't do something for her kitchen. I do not remember what the trouble was, but there was something very bad, and of course the entire house was in very sad state of repair. Her yard was of beaten down clay, and there were tin cans and other trash things scattered about. And an idea struck me, and I made a proposition to her, the lady. I told her, I said, if you fix your yard up and make it look like something, I'll fix your house up. And I'll come back here in about 2 weeks. And but I will have this immediate repair done that you were speaking about in your kitchen sink. So when I came back 2 weeks later, she'd cleaned up her yard. She'd made pots out of tin cans, which she'd painted green. And she'd really transformed the place. And she'd done a fine job. And she was very much concerned with what I was going to say. So I looked it over very carefully, and I'm quite susceptible to that kind of performance of gardening, as it were. And I congratulated her and went in the house and see what was to be done. I'd also found that I had a Muresco, quite a few cans of it. And I told her, now I tell you, I can Muresco your walls and improve the appearance of the inside of the house quite a lot. Well, she was most enthusiastic. So I sent her over to the, painter over to her house with these sample colors of Muresco for her to pick out what colors she wanted. Well, the way those are put up, you dilute them. For instance, if you have a blue, the basic color in the can, the powder, would be an intense blue, the kind that almost stands out from the wall. And you would dilute, I suppose, 10 times to get the color of blue you would want. The carpenter, painter, came to me in some concern and said that she wanted these things done in the at the original intensity of the powder, the basic color, and is going to be terrific in color. For instance, she wanted her living room red. Well, it's very hot down there in the summer, And this red was just like lighting a fire. The blue was the kind that created a haze in the room, unless it is diluted down. I told him, I said, well, now, she's never had anything of this kind in her life before. And she did by me, she fixed up her garden and all. And it's already having an effect on the other gardens. The other women are at work. You give her just the color she wants, however unfortunate it is. After he finished it, he begged me to come over and see it. Well, actually, when you opened up the front door, the room, the living room, just almost knocked you down. It was an intense red, just a terrible red. And the kitchen was this vivid blue, and she was just pleased to death. Now, all the other women were coming there to see this, to find out if they could have something like that too. But I've always remembered the original colors that she did her house in, and she certainly got a dose of it when she finally went after it. Anyway, all the other women down the line started fixing up their lawns. And it reminded me very much of a story in the Saturday Evening Post last week, where I think the title was, or maybe it was in the Reader's Digest, that beauty develops itself. Is it something of that sort? Anyway, they took one little section of the town, the garden club, and fixed that up, window boxes, things of that sort. And all over that section, the others began to do the same thing. Anyway, that was one of my experiences in command at Fort Reno. Fort Leavenworth, 2. A. I do not remember the recommendation from Major Abercrombie. I do remember that we'd had a competition in the post school for the Leavenworth detail, and I had come out 1, 2 years, but I was never given it. It always went to some higher ranking officer, none of whom did it all well, and all of whom came back with many criticisms and attacks on the Leavenworth procedure. The third year, nobody put in for it. And they sent a list around later on account of an inquiry from regimental headquarters. And it developed afterwards that I was the only one that put down yes, that I wanted to go. And therefore, I got the detail. And that's the way I went to Leavenworth. I remember particularly my shock when I reached Leavenworth. And we were in the business of selecting quarters. But in the meantime, we lived in whatever temporary assignment we had. And I was with a fellow from the 1st Cavalry. Well, their candidate had been either 1st or 2nd for 3 or 4 years. And I discovered to my horror that this man had been coached for a year. He'd been sent all the material of his predecessor at Leavenworth, and he was very well prepared. I had never heard of such a thing. And the first tactical problem the tactical problem he's working on, he asked me a question about, he developed, I'd never seen a tactical problem before. And yet he had solved or gone over every one of the previous year. And I wondered what was going to become of me without any preparation of any kind. But it was rather a dismal performance by the colonel of the regiment to send a man there without any opportunity to prepare himself in any way. I discovered, on the other hand, that most of the cavalry regiments did this, and their stand was, they were very pronounced, the stand of their men. And as I recall afterwards, I heard that when they were debating about an increase of the cavalry or the infantry, it was said in the War Department by the cavalry members of the permanent staff there that the stand of the infantry men at Leavenworth showed that they didn't have the gray matter and all that was desirable, and the cavalry was very much ahead of them, all of which came back apparently from this fact that they were in no way prepared while the others were coached and carefully selected. B. General Bell made a tremendous effort to develop Leavenworth, first while he was commandant and later while he was chief of staff. He was opposed in a great deal of this, and it was called Bell's Folly. It was made fun of. And I finally remember that there was an attack on it which got into Congress, that we were, I was not involved in that, that they were developing the German system when the French system was much better. And therefore that came in for a few comments of those who wanted to attack General Bell, and many older officers of the Army who were very critical of him because of his activity and his feeling that all the officers should be very highly educated, which was not the case at that time. And at Leavenworth built up, West Point was supposed to be, in a sense, the end of your technical military education, when as a matter of fact it was hardly high school as compared to the rest. C. General Morrison came to Leavenworth as a major and was an assistant professor in the military art or tactical department. Another officer was the head of that, and who didn't think very much of Morrison. The students all took to Morrison immediately, and he spoke a language that was new to us and appealed very much to our common sense. He was a self-prepared officer. He had studied everything he could find, German and French, and I might say that they had the systems at that time, whereas we in our country had none. Colonel Arthur Wagner was a War Department officer who tried to develop military preparation above the West Point courses, and was very much ridiculed. He wrote one or two books, and that damned him as being an impractical sort of an officer, all of which was quite outrageous as a matter of truth. But the opposition to any studious preparation of the older officers was very, very decided, and they were particularly critical of Wagner and very, very hostile to all General Bell's proposals regarding Leavenworth. Major Eben Swift was a cavalry officer of some standing, as was Captain Thayer. They were instructors at Leavenworth when I went there and had quite outstanding reputations. D. You mentioned several classmates of mine. Heron became a lieutenant general, command out in Hawaii towards the end of his career. DeWitt became the quartermaster general of the Army, and before that he was the G4, or great suppliant, of the army that fought the Meuse-Argonne battle. He's a very fine fellow. And later on, under me, he commanded the territory of Alaska and the west coast from Mexico north to Seattle. That was during the war. Fuquay was quite a friend of mine, and he I noticed in some place in some of these he was carried as chief of staff of the 1st Division at the start. He wasn't chief of staff of the 1st Division until almost at the end of the active fighting. Gamal King was once chief of staff. I was briefly chief of staff. Hanson Ely was chief of staff. Uh, Fuqua, I think, was first under me at Army headquarters. I was chief of operations, and he was in the troop movement section of that division of my staff at Army headquarters during the Samuel and Meuse-Argonne battles. Later on, he became chief of staff of the 1st Division when I released him from Army headquarters in order to give him a chance. And then he went on from that to become chief of infantry and an officer of considerable prominence. In E, you comment on the fact that I was in the School of the Line, and I think it was called the Infantry and Cavalry School the last year I was there, and it included artillery and engineers and Signal Corps, as well as infantry and cavalry. The name changed, I think, the second year I was there, when I was a member of the Staff College. The Staff College was obtained at that time out of about 100 and some odd who were in the School of the Line. The first 24 were in the Staff College, and that made tremendous competition to be of the first 24. Later on, the criticisms were so severe so continuous as to course was too stiff. The requirements were too exacting, that they cut down on the marking procedure and also on the course, which I always thought was a great mistake. The time I was at Leavenworth, it was going through a considerable change. They were, in a sense, finding themselves. And some of the outcomes were very interesting. I was there 2 years as a student, first in the School of the Line and then in the Staff College. And then I was an instructor for 2 years. Incidentally, I was the only lieutenant in the school at that time. And it made it a little ticklish, but they all became my warm friends, and the great majority, I think, of the division commanders in the First World War were their students when I was an instructor. Anyway, as the school developed in a more practical, getting more practical all the time, it was a very interesting procedure. The competition was intense, but as I always felt it was a good thing, because the officers that, under a strain, got rattled, did exactly the same thing when they got into battle. And I spoke of the difficulty about the courses, that we were rather following the German model. We were using the German maps, particularly around Metz. The reason was we had no maps of our own suited to these problems. The problem was drawn up based on a German map, the Metz map most of the time, and therefore the criticism of those who were against any education that caused you to have to study after you got your commission, and those that are critical of General Bell's efforts to advance the school, and those that just criticized on the general principle, if you did it, you were wrong. Therefore, it shouldn't be German, it should be French, or something of that sort. Well, the only textbooks we had on any of these problems, which was a series of problems, were in German and based on the Metz map. Grippenkurl was called, by a Colonel Grippenkurl, problem after problem, and these were used in the school. We became as familiar with this map, very much more so than any map I ever knew in this country. We just knew every detail of it, because the competition was very intense, and we worked at it very, very hard. So we became intimately familiar with every detail of these maps around Metz. Of course, the great battle of Gravelotte was fought on the Metz map, on the map representing the, on the ground represented on the Metz map, and the later operations around Metz itself were on ground represented on that same map. I'm speaking now of the war of 1870 and 71, when the French were so terrifically defeated. Well, several things came up that hark back to those days, very decidedly during the war. In the first place, all these fellows became very intimately acquainted or associated with each other, and in a sense very fond of each other. It was like a college spirit, only more intense, because you were involved in struggles of your real career. And a lot of them would go through these same problems each year out of the Grippenkur book until we actually finally prepared our own books, having had the Geological Survey make very complete maps around Metz and later around Gettysburg. Well, when I was over in the war, I was visiting two or three divisions to see if they were prepared to make the preliminary move out of the St. Mihiel action to the Meuse-Argonne, which was being prepared for at that time in the midst of the action of St. Mihiel. And it presented very complicated conditions because we had to take troops out of a going battle, cross them over the rear zone, tremendously active, of a going battle, and move them up into the Meuse-Argonne sector, which is north of Bar-le-Duc. And Sully, the famous French headquarters during the Battle of Verdun, was in the center. And the great road through Sully, which was called the Sacre Via, because the eventual successful defense against the Germans and the famous Verdun's attack was attributed to the fact that this road was so run that it handled this immense traffic of supply and troops, etc., that went on at the time. Well, I was, as I said before, visiting two or three divisions who had received orders, preparatory orders for this move. And I was checking up on what they had gotten and what they were preparing to do. I came to one division, which was its chief of staff, became a very famous officer in the army later and a division commander in that war and a major general, Preston Brown. He was famous not only for his efficiency and his vigor, but for his amusing comments, which sometimes took the hide off. I had persuaded him to go to Leavenworth. He was very contemptuous of it. And we met together at one of these shoots at the great target range, Camp Perry in Ohio. And I infused him with the idea of going there, and he put in for it. And as he came out either one or two in the course, he did very well and marked the beginning of his great progression in the Army, which eventually came out to command a division in the Meuse-Argonne battle. I met him as chief of staff of this division. He was over on the right flank of the army, not so far from Metz, which was in German hands. So he immediately took me up on a hill and had me look through the telescope, range observation scope, at a certain woods. And he wanted to know what woods that was. I said, well, I didn't know. Then he allowed me to look at the map. And this was the Denkmal. Notice the Denkmal was a monument. It was the hospital woods, Hopital Wald, Well, I said, what do you want me to look at that for? Well, he said, they cut me about 40 times on that damn woods. So every time I get sore here, I turn the artillery on it. Now, I said, you have the privilege of firing 2 regiments of artillery on that wood now if you want to get any diversion and any revenge from your troubles at Leavenworth on the Metz map of Grippenkerum. So we did fire a regiment momentarily, very briefly, on the Hoverwald. Well, all these places were familiar to us, and we were coming right into them. And finally came the great concentration for the Meuse-Argonne. And as I say, it went across the rear zone of the St. Mihiel battle and then cut up towards the Meuse-Argonne front. When I went to work on this troop movement, it's one of the most difficult ones I've ever heard of in military performance, prior to the great rush across Europe in the last war, I found that I was familiar with the names of practically every village, every city, more so almost than the little villages and all near my home, because they were all on this Grippenkerl map and had all been involved in Grippenkerl problems, and they were right in the track of the great moves that we were making towards the Meuse-Argonne front. Well, it seemed rather a commentary on the fact that we were being criticized even in Congress for using German maps and all when it developed afterwards. They were most useful to us in our being familiarized with the very ground we were going to fight over. There was another interesting thing came up in connection with this battle. I was always interested in the fact that Philip Sheridan, was sent over there as an observer. And being a famous cavalry leader, really being the creator of new cavalry tactics, he was treated with very great consideration by the Germans. And he joined the German army in the preliminary phase of before the Battle of Gravelotte. It was the phase that involved the great cavalry actions. And the officer who was looking out for him was the famous, his foreign minister, secretary of state, or what he was. I'll remember his name a little later. But he was the leading character in this that was not the straight military commander. So he took Sheridan with him in his carriage. And he saw the preliminary movements for the transfer of the army that was going up to capture the French army and Verdun. Not Verdun, but... it's the scene of the French army surrender and that of the Emperor, Napoleon III. So... they first went a little east, down to the river, and then back up along the road which led from Metz to right across that section of France that we were in, through Bar-le-Duc, and on to Paris. In the description that Sheridan gives, he's very detailed about parts of it, and it's very interesting. It was very interesting to me for that reason, because I was here on the ground in a war which involved that same territory. Commercy was the principal city before they got to Bar-le-Duc. I could really pick out the house that Sheridan stayed in with his distinguished host there in Commercy. He described the movement into Bar-le-Duc when they were going due west, and then the turn there when they turned to the north and headed up to what later on became the Meuse-Argonne field. He got on a balcony and watched the Bavarians come into the town and turn north there, heading up towards what was to be the Meuse-Argonne front. And then he and his host, they were following in the wake of King William, went up the road in that direction. When they got pretty well up, almost to the Argonne Forest, they learnt that some French troops had been surprised in their bivouacs, well to the north. So Sheridan got permission to go off with this clump of staff officers who were going up that way. And so he gives quite a description of that. And they came up to a certain forest, I've forgotten, I think it is Delia, some D-I-E-U-L, I've forgotten the rest of it. And they went through this woods, which was littered up with war paraphernalia, which had been cast loose. And they came out of the woods and looked down into this valley, where there was a little town down there. And it was in that town that the Germans had surprised the French, literally in their billets, though some of them were bivouacked outside. And this division that was surprised was pretty well destroyed or captured. Beaumont, I think, is the name of the town. Well, I tell this because in the Meuse-Argonne battle, through this same forest, the forest of Delia, D-I-E-U-L-E-T, something like that, our 2nd Division pushed ahead through this narrow road through the forest and came out on this same hillside looking down on the village of Beaumont and captured German officers literally in their billets. It also went on to the river, turned north and paralleled the riverbank or northwest and came out in high competition with the 42nd Division at the capturing of the fords which led over into the village where the Emperor Napoleon III was made a prisoner himself. Now the remarkable part about this to me was that in the first case it was a German army coming from Germany pursuing a French army retreating and heading up north towards the French army, which was deployed to the north. And this early surprise action occurred in the vicinity of this village of Beaumont. Now here again, generations later, you find an American army going over this same route, moving west, pursuing a German army, and up through the same woods to surprise part of it in the same village of Beaumont. I thought it was a very remarkable historical repetition, but in reverse of the troop setup. Here the Germans were retreating, and the Americans were pursuing. It would have been the French if the French had been there, but they weren't there. And the captures, the surprise, occurred at the same identical place, so that it's pretty hard to tell in war what is going to happen next, and it's well to be prepared in any direction. Leavenworth was immensely instructive, not so much because the course was perfect, because it was not, but the associations with the officers, the reading and discussion we did, and the leadership, though he was put in a minor capacity, of a man like Morrison, had a tremendous effect on, certainly on me, and I think on most of my class in those days when I was in the staff college in particular. I know I was a little bit discouraged at the start. I hadn't any preparation. I found all these other fellows had copies of all the problems of the previous year. I myself had never seen a tactical problem of that nature, and I had it all to do. So I knew I'd have to study harder than I'd ever dreamed of studying before in my life. And I just worked day and night. My great trouble was going to sleep at night. And I remember I used to get up and shine my boots in order to wake up. So I had very, very shiny boots at that early period. I finally got into the habit of study, which I never really had had, but I'd revived what little I'd carried with me out of college. And I became pretty automatic at the business. It worked out all right because in the end I came out number one, but as I say, I was discouraged because I found in the library early in the course, practically in the first week or two before we'd gotten started or anybody had seen any of the marks, and some of my classmates had been cogitating about, as they were bound to do, as to who would make the staff class, who would be of the fortunate 24 who stayed another year. That was very important because you couldn't go to Leavenworth unless you couldn't go to the War College in Washington unless you completed that second year. And you couldn't complete the second year unless you made it by contest in this and became one of the fortunate 24. I've lost the trail of my thought. So to go back, I taught myself to study very, very hard, and I took nothing for granted. If it is a simple statement, I memorized the statement. I just kept at it the hardest possible way, the hardest work I ever did in my life. And when you solved the problem, they were marked in tenths and hundreds percentage carried out to that decimal point. And we went through five different tests in the first few weeks, all very simple things in a sense, and I developed a position which put me in another light to my classmates who had left me out entirely of the estimate of who was going to be in the next year's staff class by coming out one, as I recall, in the first five subjects. In F, the names you mentioned are all familiar to me. Captain Cole was the engineering instructor. Cheryl was an assistant engineering instructor. Later, I became one of the engineering instructors. And also, I had a little of the military art part. Kruger was in the staff college when I went in the School of the Lion. And I didn't recall his teaching German then. I knew he was translating. In the class succeeding me were Mosley and Billy Mitchell and John Palmer and a number of other men who reached great prominence in the First World War. The chief of staff of the AEF succeeding Harbord was of this number, either in that class or the class following. And in other words, he was a student officer and stood one. And I think of the 29 combat division commanders that got into action in France, some 26 or 7 were graduates of Leavenworth during this period. That can be checked up on. Maybe it's too many, I don't know. But of course, what happened was these older officers saw the light and applied to go when other officers were super critical of Leavenworth and didn't go. Well, the result was those older officers that went received preferment in the assignments. And as I say, a large number of them commanded the divisions. The chief of staff of the AAF came out of this class. And at one time, 4 out of 5 assistant chiefs of staff were all from Leavenworth men of my day. You use the expression, most of my students were senior to me. I think they were all senior to me. I think I was the only lieutenant in the school. There came a period there when I was chosen as associate editor of the Infantry Journal. I took great interest in this work. I learned quite a bit about the thing in trying to do it. And I also came into association with a very splendid officer, George Shilton, who died rather early in his Army career. In F, Fry's comment on the social life is fairly correct. As an instructor, I went out to some of the dances and saw people around. I was not working at night like I was before. And but most of the profit to me came out of my associations with these, and also out of the experience in dealing with these older officers, with whom I'm happy to say I got along with very well. I did some hunting, as much as I could find a place to hunt. I had a hunting dog with me, and of which we were very, very much devoted, and I rode practically every day. I remember I bought a horse, young horse, and trained it. I wanted to learn how to do that, and that occupied a great deal of my time, of course, particularly in the riding hall, which I didn't like very much, but I undertook to try to train the horse, and he was one of the kind that has the light-colored mane and tail. I've forgotten the name of them, but you will know what they are. We were sent off to National Guard camps during the summer, and were encouraged in trying to develop them in the business of having maneuvers, though they had to be very brief, of course. Out of that grew up an association with me from Leavenworth in the Pennsylvania National Guard. That was my state, but the association came entirely from my being suggested by the Chief of Staff, General Bell, and sent to them in the summer. Later on, they consulted me on these things and had me try to pick out the officers to go and decide on the program to be followed, which took us to Gettysburg and back to Mount Gretna and places like that. It built up a very agreeable association to me, and also a very valuable one, because I could try all these things experimentally on these Pennsylvania fellows, and they didn't always know I was trying. Same thing happened up in Massachusetts. I went to the 1st Corps Cadets up there first, and then to the 2nd Infantry at Framingham. They treated me splendidly, and I got a great deal of interest and a great deal of experience out of it, and improvement in such matters. Because here I had a chance to plan and do things I would have had no opportunity to do at all in the ordinary regular garrison with my lack of rank. I went to Massachusetts as an instructor, I think, two or three times. And finally, was taken over to New York and developed the plans for the Connecticut Maneuver Campaign, which involved quite a large body of troops, I think, in the neighborhood of about 25 or 30,000, where I had to plan the maneuver and everything connected with it, and still was tied down to the necessity of having very short marches in the early days by the National Guard. 4 miles a day, I think, was the first march. Even that took the blisters on all their feet, but it made it very hard to get a tactical problem that was logical with these restrictions in distances. But that was the way it had to be done and ought to be done, because you can't take a man from behind the counter in a store, put him in heavy marching shoes the next day, and expect him to be able to trudge about the country without just taking all the hide off his feet. As to A, B, and C, on the general questions, Leavenworth, I don't think, has changed a great deal in its general appearance. on the outskirts are new buildings coming from town and over towards the river. But as far as I know, the old post is virtually unchanged. And it's always very picturesque to me, particularly the ruin of the first frontier fort there on the edge of the old parade. We lived in an old set of quarters off the old parade at first, and I became quite familiar with it. Later on, we lived in bachelor quarters, which wasn't so very good, satisfactory arrangement for a married couple, but that's the best we could rank for. And finally, we lived on Auger Avenue, Pope Avenue rather than Auger, and I think we were there 2 years. As to General Bell, to go back to the post, it is a very attractive place to walk. You could walk up on the mountain there. You could walk on the road towards town. And a great deal of our work involved us in riding all around the countryside. Now as to General Bell, he was only there on rare occasions. He was intensely interested in the school. But I didn't come to know him at all well until after that date, though he had to personally approve of my being held as an instructor because of the fact I was only lieutenant. Morrison was outstanding. He was brought us a logic as to tactics, army organization, and things of that sort, which is of immense value to us. The work, in one sense, was not difficult. In another sense, it was extremely difficult. The competition was so intense that you might say 95% wasn't sufficient at all. It had to be 99, at least a fraction, if not perfect, because there were so many others who were going to be just about the same. And if you were going to compete, you had to be near perfection in the particular subjects. And that's what made it so hard. However, it was invaluable to me as a matter of training because I learnt a thoroughness that stood me in good stead through all the clamor and push and excitement, lack of time, and also during the war, particularly in the preparation for the Meuse-Argonne battle, where it was thrown in my lap, the concentration for it, all in a moment without any previous warning of any kind, while I therefore was working on the San Miguel action. But my Leavenworth training stood me in good stead as to habits of work, and I was able to turn out the things within the time I was limited to. The first was the concentration for the Meuse-Argonne battle. Then later on, from about the 12th of October on, I was moved into the tactical control phases. E. That's a little bit too much of a question. My reading, of course, was very helpful. My study of past operations was very helpful, and I learned how to digest them. The coverage of various operations, of course, was immensely valuable. My habits of thought were being trained, and while you might say in one sense, you could almost say little I learned I could use, I learned how to learn, and right away began to develop along more stable lines. This isn't said in the criticism of Leavenworth. It was an outcome of the procedure, and Leavenworth itself was learning all the time, and his problems were becoming more practical. At first, they were too much of a single problem. Here's the situation. What is your decision? That ended it. Later on, it became a series of situations which they call troop leading, and which are very hard to organize on a map and very hard to manage, but are invaluable in training officers. The National Guard camps were immensely valuable to me. They were an experimental value, too, because I was able to do things there with a regiment where I wouldn't be able to get command of a company on a post. Matter of fact, after that, after leaving Leavenworth and being an instructor there, I was a lieutenant in the Philippines on the post where I never commanded the company one day for the first 6 months. And yet the captain of the company was a dear friend of mine and had been a student under me at Leavenworth. It'd be difficult to characterize just what, to estimate just what Leavenworth did for the Army, except it started it in its modern education. And we pressed hard, stumbled frequently, pressed ahead, and finally out of this all came very fine technique. I was very much worried at the start of the Second World War for fear our... Well, out of the First World War, for fear our officers were too theoretical. We didn't have an actual navy in the water like the Navy did. The fleet, we had no fleet. We had no real army. Had a name, but not an army, like the First Army or the Second Army. So that the officers had to get their training theoretically. And I was very much afraid that it was going to be too much theory. But afterwards I discovered that our men were so well prepared in the theoretical part, the large factors in the thing, that they were far yonder, I thought, ahead of the preparation of that nature were the British. The British had an immense advantage in tactical information because of their battle experiences, particularly in the early part of the Second World War. But when it came to the other aspects of it, it was quite the other way around. The Americans had a basic training. Their staff officers, which enabled them to go into this work in a very well-prepared manner, much to my surprise, because I thought they would have too much of that and too little of the other thing. I knew they had too little of the other, but there's no way of doing any better, because I think they said at that time you could get all the non-commissioned officers of the regular army in the Brooklyn Stadium. The National Guard camps were a great asset to me, and the experience I got, because as I say, I could do things there. I could take temporary command of a regiment to go through some exercise. When, as I say, the most I could have hoped to reach back at home would have been a captain, captain's duties. I'll give one example. We were given a form from the new Militia Bureau, or National Guard Bureau, whatever it is called, to fill out on each camp. A lot of statistical information on the camp, and then the schedules that we went through, and then finally remarks. Well, four remarks are only about, as I recall, four or five lines. And I went through six camps, I think, one summer. May have been seven, but I think maybe six. So I came down to this remark and space, and then I decided, well, if I was going to these other camps, I'd do much better by given the benefit of the remarks after having gone through several of these camps. So I wrote in for remarks, see the report on such a camp, which was one ahead that I hadn't gone through yet. And that went on, and I sent in my report, still with the reference to the camp ahead. And finally, I was getting up close to the camp ahead. So I started and wrote the comments that I thought would have general application to all of them, and which could be the reference for all of them. And as I dimly recall now, it was about six or seven typewritten pages, probably single-spaced. And after one camp, after they did that, probably about the third of this string, I cut it down to about four or five pages. And by the next camp, I cut it down again to about 2 pages. And I finally got it down to a half a page. And I commented on several things that I thought were ill-suited to the problem of our army. One, I remember, referred to the guard manual. The other one referred to the drill regulations. In all these things, I thought that we needed to have a very much simplified setup in regard to our instructions and our regulations. In the first place, these men in the National Guard didn't have the time from their business to study in so much, and our regulations were getting so voluminous that it would be very hard for a fellow to cover them at all except in the most superficial manner instead of boning them up very carefully. And I don't remember whether this got into this phase of it or not, but I was of the opinion that all the regulations, tactical and all, should be written in two forms, one for the temporary forces and one for the regular forces. The temporary force one would have everything that they should know perfectly on the day of mobilization, which would be a considerable digest of a lot of the others. The other one is what a regular officer should perfect himself in as he went along. It was impossible for a temporary officer to get through all these things, and it is very important that somebody dissect it, digest it, and get the part that he should know beyond a shadow of doubt at the time he reported on D-Day, Mobilization Day, M-Day. I don't remember what I had in this thing. Maybe that was one of the things, one of the thoughts. I know it is always uppermost in my mind. So I sent this in. Then I finally came to my... I went abroad, stayed 6 months, and then which is quite a feat on a lieutenant's pay, which this was done on a lieutenant's pay. And part of it, you see, was 2 months of it is done on half pay. So when I came back, I arrived at a post in a blizzard near Watertown, New York, Sackett's Harbor. Cold is terrific. And how you could train men in that setup, except in a very indoorsy way, I never could find possible. But in any event, I'd only been there a very short time until I was ordered to Washington. They'd started the concentration on the Mexican border. And then I was sent on to the as assistant to the chief signal officer of the division concentrating down there, the first maneuver division, I think they called it. And I found that when I got down there that they'd taken me in order to merely into this signal corps affair just to get me present. And I had very interesting time there because here was the first division we'd concentrated since the Spanish-American War, and of course that had been a very hodgepodge concentration, and everybody was looking at the division, and I was attached to the headquarters of the division. I remember I worked out a brief plan of having maneuvers with all the staffs, headquarters, and communication details and things of that sort instead of the troops at first, and that took the chief signal officer very strongly, and he advertised it very thoroughly and put it on and had me draw up the problem and all for the procedure. It involved the whole division and a cavalry brigade. And I remember I had to organize a corps of umpires to keep this thing straight. And they had their situations which they opened at certain places. And I've always been amused because the first message that I ever knew of that came in by wireless was used at that time, was sent at that time. I sent this one set that we had where two men had to turn the cranks to generate the electrical power with the cavalry division. And the umpire with the cavalry division was the lieutenant who afterwards became head of the Air Corps and tested the first flight of the air at Fort Myer. The first message that came in from this wireless set was from him, of course, reporting where the cavalry brigade had gone to. He located himself. He said, "I'm just west of the manure pile." I have never seen the manure pile to this day, so I don't know what he was west of, but it struck me so funny to get this first message saying, "I'm just west of the manure pile," which gave us supposedly a benchmark. Actually, as I say, I've never seen the manure pile yet, so I would have to guess where the cavalry brigade was halted at that particular time. Well, all these things, like I've been describing, were a constant development of knowledge of what you could do and what you couldn't do, which came to me as a great value. And these summer camps were particularly valuable to me because I could do it pretty much any way I wanted, and I wasn't being criticized. I was being accepted with enthusiasm, and that is a great stimulant. Relative to the years 1909-1910, my father died in Uniontown and was buried in my mother's family's lot in Allegheny across the river from Pittsburgh. It is incorrect that my mother went to live with the Ewings. She remained in Uniontown for quite a long period, retaining the apartment, pursuing her own quiet life with the friends she had there. Later, she began the business of going to Atlantic City and Haddon Hall, usually, in October, and staying there at Easter. This was very satisfactory for her because she didn't have any involvements of traffic or things of that sort. Hotel was very delightful in the winter for older people, and their teas and music in the afternoon, and she could get into her chair in the hotel lobby and go out onto the boardwalk. So this was her habit for quite a long time. My sister would go up and stay with her a little bit. I would go up from Washington and see her, and her daughter-in-law, Stuart's wife, would go up and visit with her. Sometimes when she was ill, they would stay there for quite a long lengthy period.